Recorded Books presents The Devil's Arithmetic by Jane Yolen. Narrated by Barbara Rosenblatt.
Chapter 1. I'm tired of remembering, Hannah said to her mother as she climbed into the car. She was flushed with April sun, and her mouth felt sticky from jelly beans and Easter candy. You know it's Passover, her mother said, sighing, in a voice deliberately low. She kept smiling so that no one at Rosemary's house would know they were arguing. I didn't know. Of course you knew. Then I forgot. Hannah could hear her voice beginning to rise into a whine she couldn't control. How could you forget, Hannah? Especially this year, when Passover falls on the same day as Easter. We've talked and talked about it. First, we've got to go home and change. Then we're going to Grandpa Will and Grandma Belle's for the first night's Seder. I'm not hungry. I ate a big dinner at Rosemary's. And I don't want to go to the Seder. Aaron and I will be the only kids there, and everyone will say how much we've grown, even though they just saw us last month. And besides, the punchlines of all the jokes will be in Yiddish. When her mother didn't answer at once, Hannah slumped down in the seat. Sometimes she wished her mother would yell at her the way Rosemary's mother did. But she knew her mother would only give her one of those slow, low, reasonable lectures that were so annoying. Passover isn't about eating, Hannah, her mother began at last, sighing and pushing her fingers up through her silver-streaked hair. It could have fooled me, Hannah muttered. It's about remembering. All Jewish holidays are about remembering, Mama. I'm tired of remembering. Tired or not, you're going with us, young lady. Grandpa Will and Grandma Belle are expecting the entire family, and that means you, too. You have to remember how much family means to them. Grandma lost both her parents to the Nazis before she and her brother managed to escape. And Grandpa, I remember. Hannah whispered. Will lost everyone but your Aunt Eva. A family of eight, all but wiped out. She sighed again, but Hannah suspected there was little sympathy in that sigh. It was more like punctuation. Instead of putting periods at the ends of sentences, her mother sighed. Hannah rolled her eyes up and slipped farther down in the seat. Her stomach felt heavy, as if the argument lay there like unleavened bread. It wasn't a particularly long trip from New Rochelle to the Bronx, where her grandparents lived, but the car was overheated, as usual, and Aaron complained the entire way. I'm sick, he said loudly. Whenever he was unhappy or scared, his voice got louder. If he was really sick, he could hardly be heard. I'm going to throw up. We have to go back. As her mother turned around and glared at them from the front seat, Hannah patted Aaron's hand and whispered, Don't be such a baby, Ron. The four questions aren't that hard. I can't remember all four questions. Aaron almost shouted the last word. You don't have to remember them. Hannah's patience was wearing thin. You're supposed to read them. From the Haggadah. What if I can't read it right? Hannah began to sigh, caught herself, and turned it into a cough. You've been reading right since you were three, Mr. Smarty. She cuffed him lightly on the side of the head, and he cried out. Hannah! Her father called back in warning. Look, she said quickly to Aaron to shut him up. It doesn't matter if you make a mistake, Ron, but if you do, I'll be right there next to you. I'll whisper it into your ear. Just like they do in plays, when someone forgets a line. Like Mrs. Graham had to do when you forgot, just like that. Promise? Promise. She gave him a funny look and then pounced on him, tickling him under the arms and over his belly. When he tried to escape by turning his back on her, she got him again from behind. His laughter rose higher and higher until he almost did throw up. Hannah! Her father said again. And her mother stared at them so fiercely over the seat that they drew themselves into opposite corners, staring out their windows with expressions of injured innocence. A few miles farther on, Aaron begged, "Tell me a story, Hannah, please. Please. Please." "For God's sake, tell him a story," her father said, pounding his right hand against the steering wheel. Driving in city traffic always made him cranky. Glad to be doing something she knew she was good at, Hannah began a gruesome tale about the Walking Dead, borrowing most of the characters, plot, and sound effects from a movie she'd seen on television the night before. Aaron was fascinated by it. The zombies had just marched into the hero's house and eaten his mother when they arrived at the apartment house complex. While their father parked the car, Hannah and Aaron raced into the building. Because he was the youngest, Aaron got to press the elevator button. "That's not fair," Hannah began. But then she remembered how scared she'd been the first time she had to ask the four questions at the Seder, and she stopped. Instead, she reached out and held his hand tightly as the elevator rose to the 9th floor in a single great swoop.
"Hanala, how much you've grown," Aunt Rose said. 12 years old and already a beautiful young lady."
Hannah smiled and pulled away as soon as she could. 13, she said. It was almost true. She didn't ask Aunt Rose how anyone could be beautiful with mouse-brown hair and braces on her teeth. Aunt Rose thought everyone in the family was the most beautiful, the smartest, the greatest, even if it wasn't true. Escaping Aunt Rose's attentions by going into the bathroom, Hannah looked at herself in the mirror. There was a lipstick stain where Aunt Eva had kissed her on the forehead. She ran some water and tried to scrub it off, feeling guilty because Aunt Eva was her favorite aunt, the only one who preferred her over Aaron. Hannah was even named after some friend of Aunt Eva's, some dead friend. The lipstick wouldn't come off completely. Brushing her bangs to hide the mark, Hannah left the bathroom, worried that someone else might be lying in wait for her, and dreading it. Chapter 2. No one even noticed Hannah's entrance into the living room. They were all in a tight semicircle around Grandpa Will. He was sitting in the big, overstuffed chair in front of the TV set, waving his fist and screaming at the screen. Across the screen marched old photos of Nazi concentration camp victims, corpses stacked like cordwood, and dead-eyed survivors. As the horrible pictures flashed by, a dark voice announced the roll of camps. Auschwitz, Bergen-Belsen, Chelmno, Dachau. "Give them this," Grandpa Will shouted at the TV, holding up his left arm to the set. The sleeve of his shirt was rolled up above the elbow. The photograph of a Nazi colonel standing sharply at attention flashed by. "I'll give them this." Aunt Eva was shaking her head as Uncle Sam snapped off the TV set. Then she murmured, "Please forgive him, please. It was the war." Her voice was as soft as a prayer. Hannah sighed. "He's starting again," she whispered to Aaron. Aaron shrugged. Hannah could scarcely remember when Grandpa Will didn't have these strange fits, showing off the tattoo on his left arm and screaming in both English and Yiddish. When she'd been younger, the 5-digit number on his arm had fascinated her. It was a dark blue, very much like a stain. The skin around it had gotten old, but the number had not. Right after Aaron's birth, at his bris party, when all the relatives had been making fools of themselves over him, Hannah had taken a ballpoint pen and written a string of numbers on the inside of her own left arm, hard enough to almost break the skin. She had thought that it might please Grandpa Will as much as the new baby had. For a moment, he'd stared at her uncomprehendingly. Then suddenly he'd grabbed at her, screaming in Yiddish, "Malachamoves," over and over, his face gray and horrible. Everyone at the party had watched them. It had taken her father and Aunt Eva a long, long time to calm him down. Even though they tried to explain to her what had upset Grandpa Will so, Hannah had never quite forgiven him. It took 2 days of hard scrubbing before the pen marks were gone. She still occasionally dreamed of his distorted face and the guttural screams. Strangely, though, she'd never dared ask what the words meant. In her dreams, she seemed to know. No one had ever volunteered to tell her. It was as if they'd all forgotten the incident, but Hannah had not. "Mama," Hannah said when the TV was turned off and calm restored at last to the room. "Why does he bother with it? It's all in the past. There aren't any concentration camps now. Why bring it up? It's embarrassing. I don't want any of my friends to meet him. What if he shouts at them or does something else crazy? Grandpa Dan doesn't shout at the TV or talk about the war like that." Grandpa Dan wasn't in the camps, thank God. He was born in America, just like you. That's because my family came over to this country in the early 1900s, second class, not steerage. She got that faraway look that signaled she was about to recite another part of the family saga. Hannah knew there was only one escape. "I think I'll help Aunt Eva in the kitchen," she said quickly, and ran from the room before her mother could continue. Although it was Grandma Belle's place to light the candles in her own home, over the years it had become a family tradition to let Aunt Eva do it, compensation for her not having a house or family of her own. Aunt Eva could have been married, not once but 3 different times, even though, as Hannah's mother had pointed out, she was no great beauty. But Aunt Eva had preferred living with her brother, Will, and his wife, and helping them raise Hannah's father when Belle was away at work. "Why did she do it?" Hannah had often asked. "Because she wanted to," was the only answer her father had ever given. "Maybe she likes kids," Rosemary suggested once. "Maybe she likes cleaning house. I have an aunt like that." "And what does she do?" Hannah had asked. "She's a nun." "Don't be a jerk. Jews don't become nuns." "So they live with their brother and take care of his kids." "His kid," Hannah said. "My father's an only child." But none of the answers satisfied Hannah's need for romance and a perfect story. Still, she eventually stopped asking the questions, and the only issues she ever brought up with Aunt Eva herself had to do with everyday things, like how many teaspoons of sugar went into a glass of iced tea, or what took a stain out of a leather skirt, or how to knit a scarf, or make potato soup, or where to find a pair of old-fashioned shoes for the school play. Aunt Eva had always had the answers to those sorts of things. When Hannah had been younger, Aunt Eva's answers had seemed magical. But as Hannah got older, the magic disappeared, leaving Aunt Eva a very ordinary person. Hannah hated that it was so, so she pushed the thought away. Still, when Aunt Eva lit the holiday candles, broad hands encircling the light, her plain face with its deep-set, coffee-colored eyes took on a kind of beauty. The flickering flame made her look almost young. Watching Aunt Eva saying the prayers over the candles was the one moment in all the family gatherings that Hannah had always found special. It was as if she and her aunt shared a particular bond at those times, as if the magic was still somehow alive. "A yahrzeit for all the beloved dead, a grace for all the beloved living," Aunt Eva always whispered to Hannah before reciting the Hebrew prayers. Hannah whispered along with her. Even Aaron tried to get in on the act, but he mumbled the words a full beat behind. Annoyed, Hannah poked him in the side, but he shifted away. In frustration, she caught up the fleshy part of his upper arm between her fingers and pinched. He cried out. "Hannah!" her father said sharply. Hannah felt her face grow red, and she looked down at her plate. Chapter 3. During the endless Seder dinner, and the even more endless explanations from the Haggadah, Hannah frequently glanced out the window. A full moon was squeezed between two of the project's apartment buildings. Her grandfather droned on and on about the plagues and the exodus from Egypt. Maybe it was an interesting story, if someone else told it, Hannah thought. But Grandpa Will had a voice that buzzed like the plague of locusts, and he made sour lessons at every pause. The Seder wasn't even in the right order, not like they taught in Sunday school. When Hannah tried to protest, she was shushed down by Uncle Sam. "It's Will's way. Don't make trouble," he said. Hannah stared at the moon. Tomorrow they'd be going to Grandpa Dan's for the next Seder. At least there would be three cousins her own age. All boys, but that couldn't be helped. And they'd get to sit at the kitchen table away from the grown-ups. And Grandpa Will wouldn't be there, shouting and making a scene. Only Grandpa Dan. Sweet, gentle, silly Grandpa Dan, who told stories in between the readings and said things like, "How do I know? I was there." Beside her, Aaron was moving restlessly, getting ready to ask the second question. With the yarmulke covering his fair hair, he looked like a miniature Grandpa Will. Hannah almost laughed aloud, remembering what Rosemary had asked at her first and only holiday visit. "Why do they wear those beanies?" Aaron's hands shook, and a page in the Haggadah flipped over by itself. Hannah reached out and smoothed it back for him, and he smiled up at her gratefully. He had the greatest smile, Hannah thought. He won't need braces. "Stop worrying," she mouthed at him. At her urging, he plunged into the second question, chanting the Hebrew perfectly because he'd memorized it. But when he looked down at the book to read the English translation, he stumbled over the word herb, pronouncing the H. Uncle Sam snorted, and Aaron stopped, mortified. He looked around the table. Everyone was smiling at him. It was clear that he'd made some silly mistake, but he didn't know what it was he'd done. He turned helplessly to Hannah. "Herb," she corrected with a whisper. "Don't pronounce the H." He nodded gratefully and started on the English again, finishing too loudly and in a rush, a sure sign he was unhappy. "On all other nights we eat vegetables and herbs of all kinds. Why on this night do we eat bitter herbs especially?" Why indeed, Hannah wondered, since they're so disgusting. Rosemary gets to eat jelly beans, and I get to eat horseradish. It isn't fair. She realized suddenly that she'd spoken the last words out loud, and everyone had heard. Embarrassed, she stared down at her hands, but her anger at the injustice continued. "Of course it isn't fair," whispered Aunt Eva to her. "But what has fair to do with it?" She smiled, and to break the tension, started singing Dayenu in her strong, musical voice. The rousing, repetitive song carried them all along, even Hannah's mother, who was tone-deaf. Dai Dayenu, Dai Dayenu, Dayenu, Dayenu. Hannah knew it meant it would have been enough. But she suddenly felt that nothing was enough except to get out of that room and that Seder in which nothing fair or fun was happening. And then she remembered the wine. That, at least, was new. When the Seder began again, she would get another glass of watered wine. For the first time, she was being allowed to drink along with the grown-ups. "Let Hanele join in the toasts for real," Grandpa Will had said before the Seder had begun.
Now, Poppy, Hannah's mother protested. She's only 12. 13, Hannah said. Ava had patted her hand. And when my sister Ava was 13, what she would have given for a little glass of watered wine, Grandpa Will had begun. It was the same kind of argument he used for everything. He never had to finish the sentence, for no one could withstand the promise of guilt. All right, Poppy. Grandpa Will had smiled, turning to Ava. See? They can't keep her a baby forever. Babies, like Aaron, had to make do with grape juice. Hannah had been grateful to her grandfather for that, and she discovered, with the very first toast, that she liked the sweet, cloying taste of the wine, even though it made her head buzz. Hannah! Aaron tugged on her sleeve, and his eyes were full of mischief. It's time! Time? For a moment, she thought he meant time for the next toast. And then she realized he meant time to steal the afikoman, the matzah wrapped in the blue embroidered cloth. Looking around the table, she saw that the adults were all suddenly very busy talking to one another. She remembered when, as the only child, she'd been the one to take the afikoman. She'd thought herself terribly clever when she found it under Grandpa Will's chair. Of course, now she knew that he always hid it there for easy discovery. She smiled at Aaron, suddenly feeling very adult. You go look for it. I'll keep watch here. Okay. He slipped from his chair and crawled around to the head of the table. Then he leaped to his feet, holding the blue cloth and its crumbling contents high over his head. I found it, Poppy. Now I get to hide it. He ran from the room, but no one leaped up to follow. He's going to hide it in the bathroom, Hannah said to no one in particular. He always does. Hush, Hanala, don't spoil things, Aunt Rose said. You always hid the afikoman under Grandma Belle's pillow, Aunt Ava said. You knew? Uncle Sam guffawed. You left enough crumbs. Knowing and not knowing, her mother said, and sighed. It's all part of the game. And the game is to uncover the hidden order of the universe. Seder means order. I read that in a book. What hidden order? Grandpa Will said. Do you think there was order back in the camps? Do you think... Ava interrupted smoothly. Lily, Lily, you are much too serious about these things. Let the children play. They are children for such a short time. And it's not as if we keep kosher or do things as the rabbi would. We do it for the children. Isn't that right, Belle? Grandma Belle nodded. So they can have fun and remember their history. Brushing the stray wisps of white hair from her broad forehead, Ava rose. Here we come, Aaron, ready or not. Signaling the others to follow her, she left the dining room. The men stayed at the table talking, but Aunt Ava and Aunt Rose went into the bedroom in a noisy search. Hannah's mother was almost as loud looking about the kitchen. They spent minutes calling out to each other about how difficult Aaron was to find this year, until Grandpa Will put his fingers to his mouth and let out a piercing whistle that brought them all back. Hannah had been waiting at the bathroom door as if on guard. At the whistle, the door opened and Aaron peeked out.
Hannah, I'm in here, he whispered.
Big surprise, Hannah said, slipping into the room.
Look where I hid the afikoman.
He took the blue cloth out of the dirty clothes basket.
That's disgusting, Aaron, hiding it in someone's laundry. They never even looked in here, Hannah. I flushed the toilet and pretended to be going, and no one came in.
He grinned. You're so smart, Ron Ron. Hannah had to laugh at his earnestness. What are you going to ask Poppy for?
A baseball glove,
She knew how much he wanted one. He'd been saving his Hanukkah money and doing extra chores.
"Good choice," she said. "No matter what Poppy offers you to buy back the Afikoman, you hold out for that glove."
She looked at herself in the bathroom mirror, wondering when the braces would come off. This summer, if she was lucky. "I got a Barbie doll dress collection once." She didn't admit that she'd regretted it right after. When she turned to say something else, Aaron was already gone. The rest of the Passover meal was tempting, but Hannah had eaten so much at Rosemary's, she only picked at her food. Besides, her head was beginning to throb. Uncle Sam poured another quarter glass of wine into her glass, then filled it the rest of the way with water for the next blessing. Suddenly she was sure she didn't want any more.
"My head feels funny," she said to her mother.
"I told you she was too young for wine," her mother said with a sigh. "Even watered wine." Uncle Sam handed around the large cut crystal goblet, Elijah's cup, and everyone poured a little bit of wine from their own glasses into it. When it was Hannah's turn, she emptied her entire glass.
"Elijah can have it all," she said grandly.
Grandpa Will smiled down the long table at her.
"What a good girl. For being so unselfish, you can open the door for the prophet and welcome him in."
"I wanted to do that," Aaron called out. "That's the most fun."
"Hannah will do it, Aaron," Grandpa Will said, "because she was so generous with her gift."
"He can have my whole cup, too," Aaron said.
"A sacrifice unasked is so much the greater," Grandpa Will stated flatly. "Come, Hannah."
Hannah stood reluctantly. She felt like a fraud. She hadn't given the wine out of generosity, but only because she didn't want it. It was no sacrifice.
"Remember, Hanukkah, we open our door to remind ourselves of the times Jews were forced to keep their doors open, to show the Christians we were not practicing blood rituals."
His last syllable was a noisy punctuation.
"As if we were the bloody ones."
Aunt Eva leaned over and laid her hand quietly on his. It was enough to calm him. He smiled at Hannah.
"Open the door to Elijah, child, and invite him in with an open heart."
Slowly, Hannah moved toward the front door, feeling incredibly dumb. She certainly didn't believe that the prophet Elijah would come through the apartment door, any more than she believed Darth Vader or Robin Hood or the Easter Bunny would. No one believed those superstitions anymore. No one except babies, like Aaron. Glancing over her shoulder, Hannah saw they were all watching her intently. Aaron bounced up and down on his chair.
"Open it, Hannah," he called out loudly. "Open it for Elijah."
"Baby stories," she thought angrily, unlatching the double bolt. Flinging the door open wide, she whispered,
"Ready or not, here I..."
Outside, where there should have been a long, windowless hall, with dark green numbered doors leading into other apartments, there was a greening field and a lowering sky. The moon hung ripely between two heavy gray clouds. A bird pelted the air with a strange, lilting song. And across the field, stepping in the furrows, marched a shadowy figure. He had a shapeless cap on his head, a hoe over his shoulder, and he was singing.
"Who asked you to be buried alive? You know that no one forced you. You took this madness on yourself."
Chapter 4.
How'd you do that, Grandpa? Hannah asked, turning around.
Behind her, the elegant meal, with its many plates, goblets, glasses, and silverware, was gone. Instead, there was a polished table on which a single wooden bowl sat between two ornate silver candlesticks. A black stove, pouring out heat, squatted against the far wall. There were shelves on either side of the stove, filled with crockery, pots, and linens. Several strings of onions hung from the ceiling. The room smelled of fresh-baked bread.
It must be the wine, Hannah thought. It's giving me daydreams.
Well? The question came from behind her in a woman's voice, strongly accented.
Is he coming?
Confused, Hannah looked around for the speaker.
The Prophet Elijah? She asked.
And do you think the Prophet Elijah walks in every time you open a door? Agoi zuktavertl. There's a fool in every house. The woman was dressed in a dark skirt, covered with a smudged apron, an embroidered blouse with the sleeves rolled up, and a blue kerchief on her head. Her bare arms were dusted with flour. Standing at a low table near a sink, she was pounding bread dough. Hannah was stunned. It was as if she'd suddenly been transported to a movie set. The illusion was so complete, she couldn't even find an answer. And then the words the woman had spoken came to her. Agoi zuktavertl. It was a Yiddish phrase her grandfather used all the time and which she'd never understood before. Yet now it was as clear as if she could speak the language herself. Agoi zuktavertl meant, as the peasant says.
So, Chaya, is Shmuel coming or not?
The woman did not look up from the dough as she spoke, but continued to beat it with a steady, hypnotic rhythm.
Hannah looked out the door again, as if it could offer her some clue. Since she'd opened one door and entered this daydream, perhaps going through another would bring her home again. It was worth a try.
Taking a step forward, she saw that the man crossing the field was much closer now. She could make him out clearly. He had a thick black beard and a full head of black hair topped with a cap. His shirt was full-sleeved, and the loose-fitting trousers were pushed into the tops of high leather boots. What Rosemary would give for such boots, she thought. The man was no longer singing, but was whistling a vaguely familiar song. When she realized it was Dayenu, she laughed.
Oh, I get it, she muttered, though she didn't really.
But she decided in that instant to play along. Whether it was a dream or an elaborate game, she'd show them all she was a good sport. It was certainly better than Grandpa Will's deadly dull Seder lessons.
He's coming, she said, turning back to the woman.
Good, set the table, and be sure to use the Sabbath cloth. This is a special occasion, after all. It's not every day my baby brother is to be married the next morning. She wiped her hands on the apron.
Well, Chaya, move!
Chaya? But that's my Hebrew name, Hannah thought. The one I was given to honor Aunt Eva's dead friend. Weird. She wondered how the woman knew that name, then laughed under her breath at her own foolishness. Of course the woman knew. She was part of this crazy game, this crazy dream. But even as she thought that, Hannah felt a panic pressure in her chest. Where was she? And where were her parents and Aaron and Aunt Eva and the others? She stared at the door again, as if it held the answer.
Why are you standing there, looking like a chelm fool, Chaya? The cloth child. I swear, the fever that carried your poor parents off, may they rest in peace, has done you more damage than we thought. It was a miracle you survived it all. And while that was surely part of God's orderly plan, its meaning is beyond me. Sometimes, child, you make me wonder.
Whatever it was the woman wondered never got said. For just then the bearded man marched into the house, having dropped his hoe somewhere outside. He grabbed Hannah before she could protest and spun her around. "Hello, little niece. Give your almost-married Uncle Shmuel a hug." Hannah knew she had no Uncle Shmuel. Certainly no one as big and bearded as this man, who smelled of sweat and grass and horses. But his joy was contagious. She gave him a hug. "Put her down, Shmuel," the woman scolded. "She's still recovering from her illness. You know how easily she gets upset and forgets things. And go wash yourself. I wonder that Fega ever accepted the Shadchan's offer for your hand in marriage. You are so much of a prize you can kiss women without bathing." She held out a large flowered bowl filled with water.
"Not such a prize?" asked Shmuel, as he dipped his hands into the bowl, slopping water over the side. "I have all my teeth and all my hair, 2 fine workhorses, a 4-room house, and 20 acres of land beside. I work hard, and I don't smell all that bad, eh, little Chaya?"
Without waiting for her answer, he lifted the water to his face and continued washing noisily. "What is the child going to say, Shmuel? She adores you. But it will be very crowded in this house with another woman if you do not bathe regularly, even though the new woman is that jewel, Fega." Shmuel reached out and pinched his sister on the cheek. "Do you adore me too, Gittel?" he asked, laughing fondly. Annoyed, she drew back from his touch, and a pin shook loose from her hair. Making a wry mouth, she removed her kerchief and drew out the other 2 pins. Her thick black hair cascaded down to the small of her back. "I adore any of my brothers the day before they get married," she said. Then, with a swift movement, she wrapped the hair around her hand into a bun, which she pinned on top of her head again. She put the kerchief back over the head and knotted it securely. Hannah watched silently, trying to take it all in. How could she be both Hannah and this Chaya, whose parents had died of a mysterious disease? She knew she was Hannah. She knew because she remembered. She remembered her mother and her father, and her brother Aaron with his big blue eyes and great smile. She remembered her house, with the jungle gym in the backyard and the 17 stuffed dogs on her bed. She remembered her best friend Rosemary, who had braces the year before she did and had showed her how to eat jelly beans with them on, even though you weren't supposed to. She remembered her school in New Rochelle. As she remembered, she forgot to be a good sport, and her eyes began to fill with tears. But the man Shmuel and the woman Gittel didn't seem to notice. They were too involved in their own conversation.
"If you would accept Yitzchak the butcher's offer, you could be married and living in a fine new house in the center of the shtetl," Shmuel said. "Then you wouldn't have to share your kitchen with Fega or anyone else." He turned and winked at Hannah. "Yitzchak the butcher is a monster. All he wants is a nurse for his children."
"All butchers are monsters to someone who refuses meat," Shmuel said.
"And he only has the 2 children, not an army. They're young enough so you could be a real mother to them, and you're young enough so you could give him even more." "Ha!"
Shmuel turned and smiled at Hannah, signaling her closer to his side. She was hesitant to go. What if by moving closer to him, she became more Chaya and less Hannah? What if by accepting the reality of the dream, she lost her memories of her actual past? She wouldn't move. No one could make her. But Shmuel's smile was so genuine. It reminded her of Aaron's. He held out a hand.
"Come, Chaya! Or do you think me a monster like Yitzchak?"
She moved. Close up, she could see there was a band of paler skin around his forehead, which his cap must have kept shaded from the sun. And he had the bluest eyes she'd ever seen, bluer even than Aaron's. In a loud, conspiratorial whisper, Shmuel said, "She is still waiting to hear from Avram Moravitz, who went 3 years ago to America, promising to send for her." But why should he send for her when he has not bothered to send even so much as a letter? I would not go to America for Avram Moravitz, even if he sent 1,000 letters. I will live and die in this shtetl, as did our parents, and as did their parents before them. That is how it should be. Gittel's mouth was set in a firm line, and she shook her finger at her brother. Shmuel began to laugh, letting it start deep down in his belly, and then rise higher and higher. After a bit, Gittel joined in. At the last, the two of them were laughing so loudly, they were almost paralyzed by their own silliness. Poker-faced, Hannah stared at them. Nothing they had said seemed at all funny, but that she'd understood them at all seemed miraculous. For the more they talked, the more she realized they were not talking in English. They were speaking Yiddish. And yet she could understand it, every word. Perhaps of all the strange things in the dream, this was the strangest. She suddenly remembered going to the United Nations with her fifth grade class and sitting in the big council room. The different representatives had all spoken their own languages, French, Spanish, Russian, Chinese, and she'd listened with earphones that carried translations of each speech. With one earphone off, she could hear both languages going at once. It had fascinated her. This was a lot like that, except that the English translations were going on simultaneously in her head. It was totally illogical. But dreams, it seemed, had their own logic. She must have made a noise, some small whimpering, because suddenly both Gittel and Shmuel stopped laughing and looked at her with concern. "What is it, child?" Gittel asked. "Are you all right? Does anything hurt?" And when Hannah managed to shake her head, Gittel turned to her brother. "I swear, Shmuel, city living does damage to the soul. When our brother, Moshe, and his wife, may they rest in peace, left for Lublin, they had happy souls. And their little Chaya, so they wrote, laughed all the time. But this grave little whimpering bird is out of a sorrowing nest. Look at her! Look!" Shmuel put a protective arm around Hannah. "She has been through a lot, Gittel. And remember how you and I and Moshe were when our parents died. And we so much older at the time, too. Besides, she is still not recovered in her strength. Don't worry. She'll smell the good country spring and eat new-laid eggs. She'll help you with the housework and me with the plow. We'll put weight on her and color in her cheeks. The laughter will return." "From your lips to God's ears," Gittel said. "For he certainly knows there's enough sorrow in the world, in the countryside as well as the city, especially these days, when laughter is our only weapon." Shmuel laughed. "Don't let Fega's father hear you say that. He insists only studying the Torah will do." "I hear Reb Baruch is a solemn man," Gittel said carefully. "Solemn? He would make a donkey look like a joker," said Shmuel. "Shmuel, that is your father-in-law you are talking about, the good rabbi of Vyosk." But she laughed and turned to Hannah. "Come, Chaya, help me set the table. We must eat and get to bed early. Tomorrow there is much to do." Hannah was silent through the dinner, fully expecting the food to fade away at her touch. She was surprised when it tasted real, not like dream food should have tasted, but she ate little of it, much to Gittel's annoyance. "And how, my brother, do we put weight on those bones when she doesn't eat?" Shmuel shrugged and didn't answer. Hannah was silent as well when they led her into the room she apparently shared with Gittel. The whole household seemed so reasonable. She had to keep reminding herself it was all a stage setting in some kind of elaborate dream. Again and again she tried to pinch herself awake. All she got for it were sore spots on her arm. At last, when she climbed into the hard little bed they insisted was hers, wearing a cotton night shift that was, also, somehow her own, and Gittel had drawn up the puffy goose-down comforter over her, Hannah let out a long sigh. It was a lot like one of her mother's sighs, and she bit her lip, remembering. If she tried hard, she thought she might even remember her mother's smell, a combination of face powder and Chanel No. 5. "Poor little bird," Gittel said, smoothing Hannah's hair and touching her cheek. She smelled of soap with an underlining of onion. "Do you miss them still so much?" Hannah nodded. "My mother," she said, "and my father and..." The rest of the words didn't seem to come. Her head began to spin. "Never mind, little Chaya, never mind," Gittel said. "Shmuel and I, we are your family now." Chapter 5. Hannah woke early, and the house was still pitch black and silent. Fearfully, she felt her way through the unfamiliar rooms in her nightgown and bare feet. The floor was cold underfoot. When she found the front door, she let out her breath slowly. Now, she thought, she'd open it and be back home. Please, please. Cautiously, she pulled on the door and stared out. Dawn was just beginning beyond the rim of the field. A thin strand of light spun out along the horizon between earth and sky. A rooster crowed his wake-up call into the clear air. "Adoo, adoo," echoed back. That was when she remembered the dream. She had been at a seder, surrounded by familiar faces, and for some reason she hated being there. The sweet wine, the bitter herbs... she could almost taste them. She heard her aunt's voice singing the Dayenu, as if from miles away. Suddenly a terrible longing for all the people in the dream overcame her, and she moaned softly. "So, you couldn't sleep either." Shmuel's voice, deep and rumbling, came from the dark behind her. "Getting married is the most frightening thing in the world, I think. But surely my marriage is not what kept you awake. Did you have another bad dream, Chaya? I worry about you and your dreams. A girl's dreams, like her life, should be sweet and filled with honey." She nodded slowly, then turned. She could see nothing in the black room. As if sensing that, Shmuel came over to stand by her side in the doorway. He was fully dressed and smoking a pipe. The curls of smoke feathered out into the open air, spreading themselves thinner and thinner, until at last they were gone. "Do you think it's strange, little Chaya, that I, Shmuel Abramovitz, with an arm like a tree, and, as Gittel says, a head like a stone, should be afraid of getting married?" He flexed his left arm at her and grinned. But above the grin, his eyes seemed troubled. "Being married might be scary," Hannah agreed tentatively. "Being married doesn't bother me," Shmuel said. "But getting married, that frightens me." Not sure she understood the difference, Hannah hesitated. "Maybe..." She took a deep breath and hurried on. "Maybe there's something everyone is afraid of. With you, it's getting married. With me, it's shots." "Shots?" "Shots, you know, needles." She jabbed her right finger into her left arm to demonstrate. He smiled and nodded. "You were very sick, I understand." "Chaya was sick, not me." He continued smiling, as if humoring her. Hannah drew in a deep breath and sighed. "My mother is afraid of snakes," she said at last.
"There aren't many snakes in Lublin," Shmuel chuckled.
"I'm not from Lublin," Hannah said. "I'm from New Rochelle. And I'm not Chaya, I'm Hannah." When Shmuel's eyebrows rose up and lines furrowed his brow, he looked so fierce, Hannah moved back a step. Of course, she said quickly. There aren't many snakes in New Rochelle, either. And Chaya is my Hebrew name, not Hannah, because of a friend of Aunt Ava's, and...
Lublin is a big place, I'm sure, Shmuel said, scratching his beard, with a gathering urgency.
And surely I am not familiar with every avenue and street, having been there only twice in my life.
New Rochelle is not in Lublin, wherever that is. It's a city all its own, Hannah cried.
Since when is a street a city?
Hannah could feel her voice getting louder, like Aaron's when he was scared, and a panic feeling was gripping her chest.
New Rochelle is too a city. It's in New York.
No?
Suddenly, remembering Gittel's boyfriend Avram, she shouted,
In America!
And Krakow is in Siberia.
I get it.
A joke to help me forget about my marriage fears.
He laughed.
Lublin in America and Krakow in Siberia. Though dear Gittel would say it most certainly is that far to both of them.
He reached out and patted Hannah on the head.
What a strange little bird you are indeed, who has found her way into our nest.
Gittel is right.
But come, my little Amerikanische, whose Yiddish is pure Lublinese. Let us feed Hopple and Popple and discuss world geography some other time. Lublin in America, Krakow in Siberia.
He chuckled again as he held out a cloak for her and a pair of ugly black tie shoes. Seeing that he was not taking her seriously, Hannah decided there was nothing else to do but go along. She took the clothes. The ugly shoes fit perfectly. Too perfectly. She shivered, then followed him out to the barn, where they fed hay to the workhorses, Popple and Hopple, in companionable silence.
Hoping for a big breakfast, Hannah was disappointed when all Gittel put on the table was a jug of milk, black coffee, and a loaf of dark bread.
No cereal? Hannah asked. No donuts? No white bread for toast?
White bread? So that is what one eats in Lublin. White bread is for rich folk, not for farmers.
Shmuel laughed.
But yesterday you would eat nothing, nothing at all, and today you want white bread?
It is an improvement, I think. From nothing to Lublin white bread.
Ah, but then I forget, you are not from Lublin. You are from Rochelle.
New Rochelle.
And where is old Rochelle? Gittel asked.
There isn't any, Hannah said, shaking her head.
What was the point in arguing with dream people who mixed you up? Anyway, she was starving, even if it was a dream. She reached for the milk pitcher and poured herself a glass of milk, took a swallow, and choked. It tasted awful. She looked into her glass.
It's got things floating in it, she said.
What things? Gittel looked.
There.
That is not things. That is the cream. You have no cream in the milk in Lublin?
Rochelle, said Shmuel.
No Rochelle, Hannah insisted.
Old new, what does it matter? Asked Gittel.
But if there is no old Rochelle, how can there be a new?
Shmuel mused out loud. Perhaps there is a Rochelle all alone, though the child does not know it.
Pilpul, Gittel said. Men love to pursue questions without answers merely for the sake of arguing.
It's what they do best. Ignore him, Chaya. A rabbi he isn't.
Hannah nodded, and noticing Shmuel wasn't eating, tried to pass him the pitcher of milk, but he waved it away.
We do not follow all the old customs, Gittel and I, alone here and so far from the village. But I think it's not bad to hold to some of the traditions, like the groom's wedding fast.
Gittel snorted.
Especially if your stomach is nervous. Me? Nervous? And what do I have to be nervous about?
Shmuel winked at Hannah, as if binding her to silence.
I heard you tossing and turning all night, Mr. I'm Not Nervous.
And I heard how early you got up this morning, even before the rooster crowed, even before the spring sun. Shmuel seemed about to answer her back when there was a loud knock at the door. Hannah jumped at the unexpected knock. Then a small hope suddenly warmed her. Maybe the knock was some kind of signal that the dream, the strange play, was over. Maybe it was her mother, or her father, or Aunt Eva standing out there. She started to rise, but Gittel got up first and went to the door. When she opened it, the door framed a man with shoulders as wide as the door itself, wiry red hair, and a bushy red beard. "Good morning, Yitzchak," Shmuel called out. Yitzchak greeted Shmuel in return, but he kept his eyes on Gittel, who gave him no more than a grunt in way of greeting. "Have some coffee, Yitzchak. It's a long way through the forest from the shtetl to here, and even longer to Fega's village," Shmuel said, gesturing expansively with his hand. "And have you heard about our little niece, Chaya?" "Little is what I've heard, but what you have here is no little girl. She's a young lady," Yitzchak said, grinning at her. "And are you feeling better? I see good color in your cheeks." Hannah looked down at the table, embarrassed by the butcher's compliments, and Gittel reached over in front of her and took the coffee pot up, placing it down again with a solid thwack in front of Yitzchak. Taking the pot up eagerly, Yitzchak poured himself a cupful that slopped over the rim. Gittel made a small snick of annoyance between her teeth and wiped up the spill with the edge of her apron. Almost shyly, Yitzchak smiled up at her, took a deep drink of coffee, then turned slowly to Shmuel. "I have 2 cages of chickens outside, Shmuel. My wedding gift. Should I leave them or take them to Fega's village with us?"
Leave them, Yitzchak," Shmuel said.
"With our great thanks. After all, Fega and I will be returning here for the wedding night, and she will see them then." "If she sees anything but your blue eyes, then she's a fool," Gittel said. "She should be counting your curls, not her gifts. We will load the chickens in the wagon with the other wedding gifts. Those schnurras and vjusk will not think we do not honor our own." Shmuel laughed. "Gittel and Chaya will stay the night with Vega's people and come back home in the morning. It wouldn't do. The walls are thin." He actually blushed, and Gittel put her hand on his shoulder. "Do not say it step by step in front of the child," she said.
"I did no such thing, Gittel. I was careful. I said only that the walls are thin. And so they are."
"He meant no disrespect," Yitzchak added quickly.
"Hush, Yitzchak the butcher. Do not tell me in my house what is and what is not."
Gittel's eyes sparked. Hannah interrupted.
"But I know what a wedding night is."
All three stared at her, and Yitzchak laughed nervously. "You see," he said, "I told you she was a young woman."
"You said a young lady, and a lady is what she is not if she knows such things," Gittel said.
"It's on General Hospital," Hannah began. Gittel turned to Hannah and shook her head.
"So, in Lublin, the hospitals tell you about these things. Then I do not think much of hospitals. And I think even less of Lublin. You know so much, my little yeshiva bucha. Telling you anything more is carrying straw to Egypt."
"Huh." She threw her hands up in the air and spun around to face Yitzchak.
"And you finish your coffee. Look how the morning flies, and we sit here gabbling about wedding nights, which will be here soon enough."
"I have still to clean the house.
I will not have Fega coming here fresh from her father's house, where there is a serving girl to clean, and think me and all in this shtetl slovens. We have to leave before noon."
"That is why I came early, Gittel, so I might help.
My children, too."
Yitzchak stood, the coffee cup still in his hand.
"The children? Oy, and where did you leave them? Outside, in cages like the chickens?"
She clicked her tongue and went to the door. Opening it, she waved her hand in greeting.
"Reuven! Zipporah! Come in!"
2 little blonde-haired children, no more than 3 or 4 years old, suddenly appeared in the doorway, silently holding hands. "Go sit at the table with my niece Chaya, the young lady over there," Gittel said. "She will give you milk with things in it and tell you stories of places called New This and Old That. Then you can go outside with her and feed the horses and chickens." "The horses are fed," Shmuel said. "The chickens I will tend to myself with Yitzchak and the children. Chaya can help you here in the house. There's enough to do." Yitzchak's massive hands made surprisingly dainty circles in the air. "My children and I will take care of the animals. Tzipora is wonderful about collecting eggs, a real specialist, and Reuven knows just when to shoo them off the nest." He smiled down at his children, who looked up at him adoringly. "We are sorry if we disturbed you. We thought we would come over early, and in that way, help."
"Help?"
Gittel sniffed, but she smiled at the children. No sooner had Yitzchak disappeared outside with Reuven and Zipporah than Shmuel laughed out loud. "I swear, Gittel, that man is already henpecked and not even married to you yet." "He's a monster," Gittel murmured. "Imagine leaving those sweet motherless children outside like chickens in cages." She began to swipe at the table furiously with a wet rag. "I thought he was nice," Hannah ventured.
"Nice?"
Gittel's voice rose.
"But then you know so much about raising motherless children, too, I suppose."
Hannah closed her mouth. Argument was useless. Instead, she began to clear away the dishes with silent efficiency and seemed to be the only one who was surprised that she was helping.
This ends Disc 1.